The following is an encore presentation of Wordland. Hello, and welcome to Wordland, stories, poems, and comedy. This week, we've got a Martian view on a British election with the Long Johns, and a story of love in old age by Andy Offutt Irwin. The Long Johns did satire in the original satire boom and just kept rolling.
George Parr, we are approaching the last few days of the most serious moment of recent British history.
So I gather, yes.
Yes. George Parr, I understand that's not your actual name, is it?
No. My real name translates as Zergon the Annihilator. But I find that an encumbrance socially.
Yes, you would do.
Because cocktail parties and
yes,
so on.
Yes, I can imagine. Yeah. Doesn't break the ice very easily. And you're from Mars, I gather.
Yes, I am. Middle Mars.
Middle Mars, yes. Yes, is that your actual, your own body there that you've got?
No, I've assumed this form in order to circulate more easily on Earth.
Yes.
Normally, you know, at home, well, it's sort of difficult to describe, really, as sort of a small blob of highly toxic jelly.
That's what you are in Mars.
Yes, I see.
Well, it's difficult for you to communicate in that form
with
human beings.
Yes, very difficult to hold a civilized conversation, in that form, because people have very little in common with a small blob of toxic jelly.
Yeah. So you are in essence an alien life form.
Yes.
And are you here on business?
Purely business. Yes. We on Mars are looking for places to expand into.
Oh, right, and you've chosen Britain.
Well, yes, it's a possibility. Yes. I'm just here to look at the lie of the land.
Yes, well, you've chosen a good moment to look at the lie of the land. When you say expand, what...
Well, usually we move into a place and enslave the local population and get them to do menial tasks.
Oh, right, yes. Well, we have experience of that. They're called Japanese car manufacturers.
Yes, normally we like to negotiate with the government in power to give them advance warning of our enslavement possibilities.
Yes.
And also, in case there are any, tax incentives we can take advantage of. But it's proved very difficult this time.
Is it?
Because, as far as I can see, I can't find the government. There's one lot of people who say they're the government and another lot of people who say they're going to be the government. Don't you know who the government is?
Well, we are, actually, at the moment, in the process of changing our government, or not, as the case may be.
Why, is it broken?
Well, some would say yes and some would say no.
Well, why doesn't the government just kill the people who say no?
That's not the way we do things
here on Earth. Well, at least lock them up.
Well, that is one of the ideas, yes. But we do have a proper procedure for change of the government. It's called an election.
Well, that sounds interesting.
Yes, you really must be from Mars. But it is a proper procedure.
I see. Well, that makes some sense, because I've been terribly confused.
Have you?
Listening to people, because one lot of people say this is the best place in the world to live and the best run.
Mm.
And another lot of people say this is an awful place to live and appallingly run. But it would be much better if they were allowed to run it and not change much.
Yes.
And that's the election.
That's what we call an election.
I see. And who decides who's going to be the governor?
Well, we have what is called a democracy. Mm-hmm. And that is to say, if you're sort of counting heads. Everybody has a vote.
So everybody decides.
Well, in theory, everybody decides. But actually, in this case, it'll be a relatively small number of people who will decide the actual outcome.
People with more heads than other people, is that right?
No.
More intelligent people, better informed people.
No. These people are basically the people who can't make up their mind. They are what we call floating voters, and the parties are very desperate for them to vote for them, you see.
So the people who choose who the government is going to be are the people who can't decide about anything.
Yes.
Yes, well, I suppose that makes sense. And who are these political parties and what do they do? Because as far as I can see, you know, they just rush around shouting at each other, calling each other crooks and, you know, things like that. But then, I mean, I come from Mars. I mean, what would I know?
No, you've got it about right, I think. Yes, but although there are differences of political philosophy. I mean, the Conservatives, on the one hand, believe that things should more or less stay as they are. And diametrically opposed to them is the Labour Party, who believe... And then there's... then there's the Liberal Democrats. But they probably won't win, because not very many people will vote for them.
People don't like them?
Oh, no, people like them, yes. They like them on the whole.
I see, but why won't they vote for them?
Because, well, they like their policies, they like their ideas, but they're worried that they would cost too much money.
And people haven't got the money?
No, they've got the money. They want to keep it.
And where does the dog come in?
What?
The dog you worship.
What dog?
You know, he's on the television all the time with sort of stirring music and...
Oh no.
Is he your leader?
Oh no, the bulldog. No, the British bulldog. He's a symbol. No, he's just an animal. He's incapable of rational thought. He couldn't possibly be our... Oh, well, I suppose... Yeah. he is a symbol. He's a symbol of Britain and a symbol of British determination to keep... things we hold sacred from falling into the hands of foreigners, you see.
I see, you're frightened of foreigners.
Well, we're very worried that we're under threat from foreigners.
Well, I can understand that, because when I was trying to park my spaceship at Gatwick Airport the other day, they wouldn't let me in because people were planting bombs there. These must be the foreigners.
No, they're British people. No, it's not them we're afraid of. There are other people we find much more frightening than them.
Who?
Well, Belgians, Germans and French people, because, yes, they're much more frightening.
And even more frightening than Martians, because I do have to say that if we decide to invade here, not to put too fine a point on it, we shall lay waste the whole land and annihilate the total population.
Yes. Can we keep the pound?
You know, it doesn't make much difference.
Oh, well, that's all right then. I think.
But come back to these Belgians. Why are you so frightened of these Belgians when they're not trying to kill you?
Well, it's government policy that we should be frightened of the Belgians. Well, that's not actually. Actually, government policy is that we should wait and see.
Wait and see what?
Wait and see whether we're right to be frightened of them.
So, why are you frightened of them now?
Because the government think that if we're really frightened of them now, they stand a better chance of winning the election.
So you're not really frightened of the Belgians, it's the government who wants you to be frightened of them.
Well, yes, I mean, the government actually started off the election by wanting us to be bored, but that didn't seem to work very well, so now they want us to be frightened.
And what about the other party, the...
The Labour Party, they want us to be frightened and bored. This is what's called a mature democracy.
Yes. So who's going to win?
Oh, well. No, we do have very sophisticated techniques for measuring voting intention, opinion polls, as they're called.
I see. So if you know in advance who's going to win the election, what's the point of having the election anyway?
Well, there is a problem. It's that people lie to the opinion poll.
Why should they lie?
Because they're ashamed of saying who they're going to vote for.
So let me get this right.
But you see, when they actually vote in the real election, it's a secret ballot, so they don't have to tell anybody who they voted for.
So an election is when a small group of people who can't make up their minds secretly choose a government that they're ashamed of.
That's right.
We're obviously a great deal more sophisticated than we thought. I mean, I think we might have to drop our invasion plans altogether.
Oh,
Oh, well, we're slightly relieved about that.
I mean, we can't keep up, can we?
Well, you have alternative targets, as it were.
Well, yes. I mean, absolutely. I mean, in a rational universe, you know, what we'd like to do is to go and take over a whole galaxy somewhere, but that, unfortunately, isn't possible.
You can't do that. No. You haven't got the technology.
Oh, no, we have the technology. We could do it, and we ought to do it, but, you know, we can't.
Why not? What's the problem?
Well, it's the old story, you know.
What's that?
The unions.
You have a problem with the unions, do you?
Can't do a bloody thing.
Oh. Well, why don't you kill them? That's what we did.
Interesting.
Thank you. Thank you, George. Put Zergon the Annihilator.
Thank you very much indeed. Thank you.
The Long Johns, John Fortune and John Byrd. Andy Offutt Irwin is a native of Covington, Georgia, but a many-time storytelling World Awards winner.
So my Aunt Marguerite's 85 years old. She has her own hospital with her friends. She was there at the hospital waiting for her friend Mary Frances to come back from lunch with another friend, Sally Lynette. And she was there. And, you know, they're old school hospital. They actually make house calls. They actually go to nursing homes and visit friends. And they take lunch off. They just close the joint. Nobody's around anyway. And Marguerite had just reopened the hospital. She's waiting for Mary Frances to come back. She's a little bit late. And Mary Frances came in, and she'd gone to a new restaurant that Sally Lynette wanted to show her. It was out on Highway 278 called Honey's. Marguerite hadn't seen a restaurant called Honey's. I didn't know there was a new restaurant out there. How long has it been there? Mary Frances said, well, Sally Lynette says it's been out there 2 weeks. Oh, we all have a good time. And Sally Lynette wanted to take Mary Frances out there, and Mary Frances came back in. She's kind of like Michael Reno. She has a toothpick in her mouth. Marguerite just thinks it's vulgar. Did you have a good time at the new restaurant? What did you have? What did you eat? Oh, I had the same thing I always had. I had a double-decker cheeseburger and a hot fudge cake. Well, how can you have something you've always had at a new place? Oh, it's just Shoney's, but the S is burned out. Well, what took you so long to get back? Well, Sally Lynette wanted me to see her front yard. She went down to the Trappist Monastery yonder in Conyers, and she bought one of those little trees that you keep in your house. And, you know, you plant them there, and you put wire on them and everything, and you clip on them and everything. You keep them forever. She wanted to show it to me. She put it in her front yard. She wants to have it be in the Guinness Book for the world's largest bonsai tree. Marguerite was chatting with Mary Frances, and in comes Lewis and his little girl. Lewis is the orderly. He's really the maintenance man, but they've given him a jacket with his name embroidered on it. So, you know, he's the orderly. He's the kind of guy that when they got the new x-ray machine, he thought it was a floor waxer, couldn't get it to work. And he's got his little girl with him. Her name is Purell. And it's kind of old-fashioned and clean at the same time. And they've got it's late in the autumn, and they have the catalogs have arrived from the mailbox at the P.O. box, and they slap them down on the counter. And Mary Frances was very excited to see these catalogs come in. And it's that time of year, you know, the gift catalogs are all coming in just about now, really. You know, the L.L. Bean. She has a lot of outdoor catalogs. When she and her husband were married, they're still married, but he's dead. But when they were younger, that's how I should put it, they would go hiking and camping a lot. They did outdoors things, and he liked to fly fish. And they would hike and camp and actually in a tent, you know, and under the stars or whatever. And she likes that sort of thing. And there are those catalogs, and they all come late in the year. And then the medical supply catalogs, they come late in the year, too. Because you might want some elective surgery. Say you have a kidney stone in February. You're going to use up your out-of-pocket and your deductible, so if you want to have something done, it's free at the end of the year. And it's true. You know, I mean, if you've got decent insurance and you've already spent all your money, so there, you know, there are the medical supply, and she's going through all these catalogs, and Marguerite said, what are you doing with those catalogs? Well, I'm trying to figure out what I want to give myself for Christmas. I'm going to get me a... I'm going to either go hiking at Sequoia National Forest, or I'm going to get a store-bought hip. Well, Marguerite, of course, knew that those things were mutually exclusive. So she had this wonderful idea. She knew exactly what she's going to give everybody on her Christmas list. Every once in a while, two or three times a year, she goes to the Trappist Monastery in Conyers. Covington people testify, there's a Trappist Monastery in Conyers, right? Yes, there is. It's a real thing. I didn't make it. It's not. No, it is. And it's a wonderful place to go. They have a garden shop. They have a lake you can hike down to, and there are geese and a couple of swans. She likes to go there, and then she'll go to the garden shop, and there's the bonsai trees. She's been there before. She's seen them. She'd never really thought to buy them. This is perfect for everybody on her list, bonsai trees. So she got in her 1968 Plymouth. She drove the 10 miles to the Trappist Monastery in Conyers. She went down to the lake, and she walked around, and she made it to the garden center, and she comes to where the bonsai trees are. And there's a fellow in his alb with the rope and the three knots and the hanging hood, hiking boots. And his name is Brother Bartholomew, and he is the keeper of the bonsai trees. And Marguerite knows immediately that this man loves these bonsai trees. And that's the way you should buy anything from a craftsperson or an artist. Don't buy anything that the artist or the craftsperson doesn't love. And she can tell this man loves these bonsai trees, and he's using old toenail clippers to clip around these trees and the wires there. And she observes him, and she watches him, and she's admiring him. And she decides on what trees she's going to buy. She's going to buy, for Mary Frances, of course, a sequoia tree. And there's a beautiful little sequoia tree. And then she's going to buy a tree for her daughter, Francine, my cousin who lives in Cambridge, the medical researcher cousin, my cousin who has HDD, humor deficit disorder. My cousin, the animal rights extremist, and I know we have some here, don't look at them right now, and they're such an extremist that even when her little girl, Drusilla, was a baby and a child before digital photography, there were no pictures of her little girl because that would require film. Film uses gelatin, which is an animal byproduct. So there are no pictures of Drusilla, no leather, no nothing like that. Marguerite had been driving one time to see a friend who was in hospice down in South Georgia. She had come down to South Georgia to see her friend, and it was in Cordele, which is the watermelon capital of the world. I have a sticker on my guitar case that proves it. I believe it. That settles it. And she got behind one of those school bus trucks. Now, if you don't know that, in South Georgia, the watermelon trucks all are old school buses with the top cut off and the seats taken out, in the tradition of my people. Fact. And she got behind one of those trucks once, and she saw watermelons fall off. You know, it's kind of collateral damage. They really pile them in. She's at the intersection. And she was so excited, she pulled her car over. There are these watermelons in the intersection. People had been running over them for a while. She got out of her car, and I had my phone, my phone, iPhone, me phone. And I had my phone, and y'all know it has a camera on it. Did you know that? It does. And I took a picture of the watermelon there in the intersection. And you can send it on the email. Did y'all know that? You can't. Y'all couldn't afford to be out here. Y'all. That's fine. No, I'm glad you're there. I'm glad you're there. I'll look at you every once in a while. I won't remember. I know why y'all are here. And you sent it on the email, and I took a picture of the watermelons, and I sent it, and I said, Francine, your love, Cordele, Georgia, all the roadkills vegetarian. As I said, Francine is a medical researcher in Cambridge. She likes being from the South. So she's going to give Francine a live oak, which is the state tree of Georgia. That'll be a perfect tree. And then for her granddaughter, Drusilla, my niece, Francine's daughter, who now is a jazz trumpet player, tours the country. Her husband went to Georgia Tech. Drusilla went to the University of Georgia. But they're a wonderful couple. They have a jazz quartet. They travel around in an Airstream trailer and a 1972 Chevy Suburban, but he went to Tech. He put a hydrogen accelerator on it. It gets 60 miles per gallon. And, you know, Drusilla's starting to sing now. Marguerite's encouraging her to sing. When she takes down a horn, she wants her to scat sing. So, you know, when you scat sing, you know what scat singing is. You need some place to kind of jump off into the scat. So she's going to give her a La Blale Pantry. La Blale Pantry. You know what? Parenthetically, a lot of people don't know this. Cab Calloway was actually a gastroenterologist. And, yeah. And his scat were like the parts of the intestine. You know, jujurum dewadum. Jujurum dewadum. Hurry, 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 ho. Yeah, a lot of people don't know that. He was a doctor to have something to fall back on. So she's got those trees picked out. She's got the live oak, the sequoia, the loblolly pine tree, and for herself, in the cemetery behind her house, the biggest old red oak tree has fallen down, and she misses that thing. It was the shade tree in her yard, and now her yard is a sunnier place, and that's okay. There's a hole in the sky, and she got herself a red oak tree. And she was putting them in the trunk of her car with Brother Bartholomew, who is the only monk there who's from the South. He's from Mississippi. The two of them were putting these trees in the car. She just liked this guy. She loved how he loved his trees. You love your trees, don't you? Yes, ma'am. Ding, ding, ding. The chapel bell was ringing. It was time for Vespers, afternoon prayer. I got to go to prayer. Well, I'll come see you. Now, when you go to the monastery in Conyers, Georgia, you go into the chapel, which is a cathedral's like building, big Gothic thing. It's not made of limestone. It's made of concrete. Or as I say where I'm from, cement. The floor is brick chip flooring, just like your summer camp where they had a drain in the middle and they could hose it out. The reverb is amazing. It's like 12 seconds. And there's a big, big Italian-made rose window in the back, stained glass everywhere. The little places where the monks sit, there's a term for that, I can't remember what it is, but they come in singing Gregorian chant, and then when they sing their hymns, they go into chants and motets, which are parallel two-part harmony mostly. And it's so beautiful. Kyrie eleison, Christe eleison. My man Keith gave me a little reverb. Thank you, my man Keith. That's me. Yeah, they love that guy and his son Eric. And they come in, Kyrie eleison. And then the monks file in front of where the pilgrims are sitting behind a little balustrade there on little hard wooden benches, which are fine. And there's one monk that comes through, Kyrie eleison. And when Marguerite heard that, she made a noise that the women in my family make when they are trying to stifle a laugh. It's a you know that sound. Well, there's a word we use in music, specifically in percussion. I'm an old percussionist. That was that's what I was in college. That was my major, believe it or not. And claves, for example, are two pieces of rosewood, and you cradle one stick here, the little, you know, inch cylinder sticks, and you take another one and you that's what it sounds like. And that sound's not loud necessarily, but it cuts. It just flies over an orchestra into a hall. A lot of people don't know, but the property of it cuts. And it flew through the cathedral-like building for 12 seconds. And you can see the monks kind of going. And the whole thing made Marguerite want to laugh even more, and she kind of stifled a grin, and she just sat still and clasped her hands in fervent prayer. And Vespers was over, so she went back down to her car. You know, you lose that feeling of the 16th century when the monk pulls out an iPhone with a square credit card reader. And she bought her trees, and She looked across the field, the beautiful field there in front of the chapel, and buckeye trees. They're in Conyers, Georgia. There's some buckeye trees. Well, you got to go pick up some buckeyes if you see buckeye trees. And she picked up her leather gloves that she keeps in the trunk of her car. She has a floppy hat, leather gloves, grocery bags, and a trowel in case she finds a plant that needs liberating. And she put on her leather gloves because she's going to have to kind of sort through the husks, which are thorny, you know, to pick up some buckeyes. And she picks up some buckeyes. I forgot to tell you a little bit about my Uncle Charles, Marguerite and Uncle Charles. She's been a widow a long time. Ask me how long she's been a widow.
Well, when Charles passed away, he got us his and hers tombstones. It's a better value. And there's his name on it, and the year he died, and the year I was born, and he was born. And there's my name on it there, and the year I was born, and then there's a 19. My tombstone's got the Y2K. I was telling my nephew Andy back when it happened, he thinks he's funny. He said, oh, calm down, Aunt Marguerite. It's not like it's etched in.
My Uncle Charles loved Shakespeare. And I have to tell you, my Uncle Charles speaks to Marguerite from beyond. She hears him sometimes. He speaks to her from beyond. Sometimes it's Shakespearean. Almost all the time it's inappropriate. But it's always loving and true. And she was walking out on that field and finding buckeyes that she's going to give a buckeye with each tree to the people she loves. And you rub it, and you rub it for good luck, and you keep it in your pocket, and you make little wishes with it. And Marguerite chose buckeyes for everybody that she's going to give a tree to. For Francine, for Mary Frances, for Drusilla. And it occurred to her, when you make wishes for people you love, it's a prayer. And Uncle Charles came to her from beyond as she stood there in that Trappist monastery. And he said, a rosary by any other name. And Marguerite said, amen. And as soon as she said amen and put the buckeyes in her pocket, started to turn towards her car, she heard a voice call a name she hasn't been called in years. Mick? Mick. That's what Marguerite's friends started calling her around the sixth grade through high school. Her initials, M-I-C, Marguerite Ivy Cook. Her friends used to call her Mick.
Hello?
Mick?
Yes, I used to be Mick.
Oh, you're not anymore?
No, I'm Marguerite. Hello? May I help you?
Which is a stupid thing to say. She didn't want to help him. He said, Ike Balthazar.
Ike Balthazar? Ike!
Ike was this kid that she knew. He was like in the sixth grade when she was a junior in high school. And then after the sixth grade, his family moved away. She never heard from him again. She used to like this kid. They used to play together. She was like the teenager to his kiddom.
Ike, little Ike.
I'm bigger now, but I'm shrinking.
Ike is good to...
And she offered her hand, and they had this nervous little goofy hug. How do you see someone you haven't seen someone?
How did you know I'm me? How could you possibly know?
Well, I was here with the monks. I deliver some bees to them. I'm a beekeeper, and I conjure bees.
You conjure bees?
Well, I conjure queens for the bees.
You do?
Yeah, anyway, I'm helping the monks with their bees, and I was here delivering them some bees. And I went to Vespers, because, you know, everything stops when Vespers happen, and I was there where the pilgrims were, and I heard Brother Bartholomew come by singing the Kyrie, and I heard a... I had to look to see who that was, and I saw this old lady. Don't miss it.
No, that's fine. That's appropriate.
But she had a particular smirk on her face, a smirk I remember from
a girl I had a crush on when I was a kid. I wonder if that's Marguerite, if she's alive. And that's who I thought you were, and that's who you are, or who you used to be. Well, it's good to see you.
And then there was a pause in the conversation.
And he said, well, I best get going. My dog's in the truck. I mean, she's not in the cab of the truck. She's in the back. But if I leave her too long, she'll jump in the cab and drive off. I left the keys.
He's funny. And she was so happy he said that. She,
well, I have a dog.
You have a dog?
She was so glad she wanted to tarry. She didn't want to leave this conversation. What kind of dog you have? A Vizsla Pointer? Dog like that needs to run all the time. That's right. Where do you have your dog run? In the cemetery behind my house. That's against the law. I know. Well, look, my son and I have an organic farm just 15 miles from here. Why don't you bring your dog out to the farm to run? Oh, that would be nice. Why don't you bring your dog on Saturday? I think I'd like that. She heard herself say. And that's what was arranged. She went to Ike's farm on Saturday, the one he shares with his son and his son's family. He has a little house about twice the size of this stage. Little den, little, you know, office, little bedroom, little bathroom, little kitchen. Very compact. His son and he built it themselves. They even milled the wood from trees they cut. And there's no stairs. It's a walkway right to the house for the guy's dotage. And Marguerite arrived with her dog. Her dog's name is Marguerite. That's another story for another time. And she opened the door and Marguerite the dog ran out and met with Rosie the lab, and Rosie and Marguerite flew away. And Marguerite said, will they be all right? Oh, they'll be fine. We have 400 acres. We have a lot of acres. And if they leave our land, they'll go into the land of mine enemy. You're an enemy? Yes, mine enemy, Harold King. He's a corn farmer. He's using neonicotinoids on his corn. And we think that might be confusing the bees so they can't find their way home and they die. We're trying to figure out why there's colony collapse syndrome. He's mine enemy. Would you like to go for a walk? Why, certainly. Where does a hike end and a walk begin? Nobody knows. Or the other way around. They're walking on this path around into the woods, there to the fields where they grow pumpkins and watermelons and soy and other things. And it's rocky, so Marguerite's watching her feet. And there was a little stumble, not a fall, as Catherine Tucker Windham used to say, young people fall, old people have a fall. You don't want to have a fall. And when she kind of stumbled, he offered his hand, and her hand landed in his hand. And they walked for a while. And she looked down, and there was a speck of yellow. And she stopped. And Ike bent down, and it was a little dead bee. And Marguerite opened her hand, and without speaking, he put that bee in the palm of her hand. Now, you know people who hum and whistle all the time? I'm here to tell you, they have tunes going in their heads all the time. And Marguerite had a tune in her head when she saw this bee, but she didn't realize it was coming out. And she sang to this little dead bee. She sang, "Luli lule, my little tiny child. Ba ba luli lule." And as soon as she hit that pickety third, she was aware that she was singing out loud. And then Ike did not want her to be embarrassed, so he sang, "Old Harold King in his raging, he will not stop his spray." He put his palm under hers. She poured that little bee into his palm. He's one of those guys that wears Velcro zipper vest with lots of pockets, which either means you're really organized or not at all. He opened up a Velcro pocket. He put that little bee right there. And Marguerite wondered how many bee carcai he might have on his person.
Well, they were together a lot. They started seeing each other. They started going places. They even went to the picture show together and sat in the back. Oldest people in the theater. They had a great time. And then Drusilla came through town, and Drusilla had a gig in Atlanta, and Marguerite said, "Now Drusilla's coming with one of her gigs. She's playing at the Red Clay Theater in Duluth. Would you like to go?" Sure. And they went to the gig, and they stayed up late, and they went to the after supper, and then they slept in the trailer, and it was great. They had a great time. And Drusilla and her band, they started making their way up north until they made it into Boston and then into Cambridge, and they played at the Club Passim in Cambridge. And of course, Drusilla's mama came, Francine, and she and her man, that's what we call him, he was there. And they watched, and then they went to after supper, and Francine, Marguerite's daughter, asked her daughter, Drusilla, "How's your grandmother?" "Oh, she's awesome. I like Ike." How funny that line was lost on that young woman. And Francine said, "Who is Ike?" "I guess, you know, like grandmama's boyfriend." "Your grandmother has a boyfriend?" So Francine, whoa, Francine hit the microphone and broke a nail. Francine, we're good. Francine called her mother. "Mother, I would like for you to come for Thanksgiving."
"All right, sugar."
"Can you make arrangements to come?"
"Yeah, I'll just tell the girls that I need to be gone for Thanksgiving."
"Thank you, mother. Goodbye." So it came to pass that Marguerite flew up there, got to Boston Airport, went to Cambridge, and there was Francine, her man, Simon.
They're not married. But they've been together for a long, long time. She's a medical researcher with two PhDs. He makes wood-fired pottery. But he's had a Fulbright, and that's a brand name scholarship right there.
And she was sitting at the counter watching the food to be prepared for Thanksgiving. Now, it was so great because Drusilla and the family got to come, and Drusilla's little boy is named Chaz, named after my Uncle Charles. And the little boy is 4 or 5. He's watching the Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade. Marguerite's sitting at the counter watching Simon prepare the food. And in Marguerite's honor, he was making a tofurkey. Don't fake meat, y'all. Just eat vegetables. And the little boy watching the parade said, "It's Phineas and Ferb. It's Phineas and Ferb. Come look, Gigi." That's great-grandmother. When Marguerite spun in her stool, she was happy to know that her feet were still awake. And she made her way to the sofa, and there were these goofy balloons. And she wondered what kind of goofy balloons these would be at Macy's, but what could be weirder than Popeye, so it's cool. And she was watching this, and he says, "I have a book of theirs." And she said, "Oh, well, let me see it." And you know when the little kid doesn't know that you can't see anything this close? He stuck the book right in her face. Well, she couldn't see. She was wearing her TV driving glasses. Now, she has 2 pairs of glasses. She doesn't like bifocals. She has her reading glasses on a chain, right? But she's wearing her TV driving glasses, and when she takes off her reading glasses, she likes to just kind of toss them, and they go bing. But boom, there's this book, and she wants to please this little boy because she wants to see what he's interested in, because she wants to have a relationship with him. So she needed to change her glasses, but she took her driving TV glasses and just sort of tossed them. But they were not on a chain. And they went skittering across the floor and hit the cabinet that the TV was on. And Francine witnessed this. Mother is throwing her glasses across the room. And that concern started to build. And then it was time to eat. Well, Simon had made a pasta dish with a tofurkey. And it smelled delicious, but it was, and he had made the pasta. He squeezed it out and everything. And, you know, there it was. And she picked up her fork.
"Let me give you an etiquette lesson now, everyone here gathered. Flatware or cutlery is acceptable. Don't call it silverware unless it's made of silver. And if it's hotel plate, that's just trying too hard. Flatware is called flat because it's flat. the handle of a fork should be flat. The thumb is the force, the brutish middle finger is the fulcrum, and the food is the load. That's the simple machine of a fork. When you hold it, all you have to do is let the flat part stay there and the tines stay up. But if the handle of the fork is a cylinder, made to look like little steel fake bamboo, and you've got a little Parkinson's, you can't twirl it.
And that's what Marguerite was doing. She was trying to, you ever tried to troll with a, if your children have those, get rid of them. And she's trying to twirl and she can't get the, she wanted to show off her hearty attitude and she can't, and she puts the fork down and she said, do your job. Mother can't eat. Mother is talking to her hand. She flew home. She knew it had gone badly. As soon as she landed, she got home. She called her daughter and said, I want you to come to Christmas dinner. Now, everybody who knows Marguerite knows that Christmas dinner for her is going to be January 6th. That's the Feast of the Epiphany. And if you don't know this, that's the 12th day of Christmas. The 12th day of Christmas, my truth. That's the 12th day. It begins on Christmas Day. Got that? There's your liturgical lesson right there, people. If you're not of my faith tradition, and people in my faith tradition still don't know that. And so that's the 12th night. 12th day of their dinner will be the 12th night, and Marguerite likes to call it that. And Francine said, yes, Mother, I'd be happy to come see you. She went down to the cemetery. She hasn't heard from Charles since she started to see Ike. She hasn't heard from Uncle Charles. She wonders what her husband of so many years would think of this man she's hanging out with. She went down, she sat on this granite bench dedicated to her cousin who was lost in World War II, lost over the Pacific. And she looked at the grave, that grave I described, the stone with her name on it. She knows that's where she'll go. She wanted to hear from him. And the wind picked up. And as soon as she stopped thinking with words, she heard from Charles. And he spoke Shakespearean to her and said, she never told of her love, but let concealment like a worm in the bud feed on her damask cheek. She pined in thought, and with a green and yellow melancholy, she sat like patience on a monument, smiling at grief. And it occurred to her right then that she was smiling, and another wind kicked up, and she knew it was all right. And Charles was quoting from the 12th night. She pulled out her cell phone right that second. She called not Francine, but Simon.
Are y'all written a card when y'all come here on January 6th?
Yes, ma'am.
Don't rent a car. I'll pick you up from the airport.
The secret to Simon's success is he does whatever the last woman who told him to do something, he does it. He said, all right. So I told Marguerite the best way, what you want to do is get on Riverdale Road from I-20 when you're on 285. Don't go all the way down to the actual airport thing. Go to the cell phone lot. She didn't know what that was. What's a cell phone lot? Well, that's where you go. You just park there. You don't get out of your car. It's just the cell phone lot. And you wait for them to land, and they'll call you.
Oh, that's good. So you don't have to keep moving, and the police tell you to go away.
That's right.
That's a wonderful idea.
She got to the cell phone lot. She had to circle around 3 times. It was full, except for the handicap section. She wondered why it was there. Nobody's getting out of their car. And if you're offended by that, I don't care. And But she finally made a lot. She was there about 3 minutes, and then Simon called. We're here. We're going to be at the Big Penguin down low. She went to the Big Penguin, and then this is the busiest airport on the planet, people. This is ATL. It's Atlanta. And she goes, and there she sees him. She does this, you know, a polite tap on her car. It's okay to tap on your horn now that people have car alarms, because it's the same kind of sound when people set their alarm. Beep, beep. There they were. He waved. Francine said, Mother, what are you doing? I'm picking you up from the airport, sugar. What? You can't do that. I just did. Simon said, you want me to drive? No, you're a tourist. Get in the back. It's all right. Simon got the big bench seat in the back of that 1968 Plymouth Fury 2. He stretched out. It's comfortable. She made it from Riverdale Road to 285 to I-20 all the way to Covington, Georgia. No incidents, no airbags deployed. Of course, there are no airbags to deploy. When they got home, Margaret said, would you like some coffee? Yes, that would be lovely. I'll go get you some. She left the kitchen, went down the hallway into her bedroom. She came back with a coffee carafe. She filled it up in the kitchen. She went back to the bedroom. This is curious. So Francine followed her mother. Simon followed Francine. And there on the marble top washstand commode was the coffee maker. And Francie said, Mother, what are you doing with the coffee maker here on the washstand commode?
Well, if I put it on the mahogany dresser, I might spill something and it will mar the wood.
No, Mother, why is the coffee maker in your bedroom?
Well, I have, you know, a radio, but I don't want to hear what they're saying when I turn it on. It might be somebody vulgar or talking about somebody vulgar running for something. And I don't want... That's a factual judgment, not a value judgment. And I have my iPhone, but sometimes, you know, when you set the little clock and it goes off, you got to rub it. You know, when the alarm goes off, you got to rub it. And my fingers are dry in the morning. It doesn't know I'm there. So, but I have a little clock on my coffee pot, you know, and I set it for, have y'all seen those, the little clock? It's wonderful, and at 6:15 it comes on, goes, and I wake up and smell the coffee.
Simon thought that was great.
Now listen, we're gonna have a little brunch at Ike's place with his son Ron, and that's what we're going to do. We're leaving very soon.
So they got in the car and they went out the 15 miles to the organic farm, and there it was. And it's an organic farm, as I said, and there's a little screened in, you know, farmer's market area there, and they went in, and there was Ron, Ike's son, and Jane, Ron's wife, and they were there, and Jay, their little girl, and they all greeted and meted, and it was kind of nervous because Francine doesn't like, you know, to be touched, and that's cool. And then Francine looked up, and there were these three charangos. Now, if you don't know what that is, it's an Andean instrument about the size of a ukulele, and the back of it is traditionally an armadillo shell, and that's what they were. They were armadillo shell little charangos. It's, you know, there they are from actually, it was made here because Ike made them. And then there were three armadillo shells with nylon straps hanging on them, and Francine said, what are these? Well, those are my triangles. I make those. I had a kit, and I learned to make them. And what are those? Those are bicycle helmets. Where did you get the armadillos? Oh, they were digging in the garden, and so I dispatched them. I shot them with my .30-06, but I only did it for the vegetables, so I'm just a vegetarian hunter. But I like to use all the parts of whatever I do, so I made those, and those things with the nylon straps, those are bicycle helmets. Because we have armadillo in North Georgia now. Did y'all know that? They're there. North. We have armadillo, and the reason we have armadillo, he was saying this to Francine, is because of the bicycle helmet. And the audience goes silent.
Margaret said, Ike, explain to Francine, she's a scientist, why we have armadillos in North Georgia because of the bicycle helmet.
Well, you see, there used to be a period called the period of the feral child. And summer was 3 months long. June, July, August, the way it's supposed to be, because we were an agrarian culture and we used to have to have the children work on the farm. So that's why we had school off during the summer. Then some child lost his leg in a corn thrasher or something, and then we had to stop that. But so the this is the only group laughing at that one. And they stopped having them on the farm because of labor laws and all that. So the children just got on their bicycles, and they ran free on their bicycles, and the dogs ran free. That's why you didn't have deer in your garden back in the day. But that's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about the armadillo. And so the children would ride around, and then one day they invented the bicycle helmet. And it's a serious-looking thing, no matter how many Disney princesses you have on it. It's serious head protection gear. And the mamas and daddies said, oh, being on the bicycle is dangerous with the children weaving in and out of the car. So they had to send them to camp. Send them to art camp, music camp, band camp, singing camp, camp. Well, the mamas and daddies can only afford so many camps. So what they did was they squeezed in most of June. They cut off August completely. They had to tear down the asbestos school, replace them with air-conditioned schools, sending more fluorocarbons up into the atmosphere. So all the children in the country and in those air-conditioned schools, making it get warmer on the planet, bringing the armadillos up north full circle. Simon was laughing really hard. Francine was not. Simon, Francine's man, and Ron, the son of Ike, got together. And they went to town together. And when they went to town together, they decided to buy each of these women a gift. And then it was time for a dinner, for the 12th night dinner. Vegetarian. In fact, Marguerite had made sugar plums with orange zest for dessert. She had told Mary Frances, I'm making sugar plums. What are sugar plums? Well, you take a dried plum and you put it in a, wait, what did you say? Dried plum? You mean a prune? No, they don't say prune on the little... They don't, do they? They says dried plums, that's right. Mary Frances said, well, that's just euphemistic. It's prune, and you should call it prune. It's patriotic. Now, I need to tell you something about Mary Frances. She's a recreational liar. And I'm not talking about professional liars like us and Bill. No, I'm talking about, you know, those people that kind of lie, but they're a dying breed because now we all have vindication devices in our pockets. Really? Is that right? But Marguerite, that's why the cell phones aren't allowed at her hospital. It's not because of the medical devices. It's just so Mary Frances can have some fun. And
do tell me how Benjamin Franklin named the prune.
Well, you see, now in 1788, he was an ambassador to France. And he was there, and he went to the Café de Régence. And when he went there, that's like a pool hall for chess players. And there was a chef there who served them dried plums, but he had invented them because he found a way to preserve the plums without having alcohol in them, which causes debauchery. And since they didn't have any alcohol, and Benjamin Franklin tried them, and he said, oh, these are prudish plums. I shall call them prunes. I would rather have me a prune of high dietary fiber than a prude of high moral fiber. That's in Poor Richard's Almanac. Anyway.
But wait. You're saying prune with an M. It was prune with an N.
That's right. But when they printed up the menu, they put an N instead of an M. And Benjamin Franklin was a printer. And he said, well, that's it then. If you've printed it, that's it. That's right. Trust not what is said, for words vanish in air, nor what's writ, for the pen swirls so fastly, but the letters of print are chosen with care, and to be in error, 'tis simply ghastly.
They all came together, Ron and Simon had gone shopping together. When Marguerite named Francine Holly after her grandmother, just as she had been named Ivy after her grandmother, it was lost on her. She didn't know. But it wasn't lost on Simon and Ron. Came time after the meal. Finally, it's time for the final toasts. And gift bags were put before these two women. And Simon stood up. And Ron stood up. And Ron spoke first. He was wearing a guitar. And he said, "Ladies, we have gift bags before you. There's a gift in there. Would you please put it on?" And inside the gift bags were little Santa Claus hats. Marguerite's said Ivy. Francine's said Holly. Ron said, "Francine, I know you're concerned about your mother and her getting older. And she is getting older. So is my dad. But for lack of any other term, these two people are best friends. And if there ever comes a time when she can't live by herself anymore, she is welcome to live in the house with my father. He and I have talked about it. There are two rooms in there. And if we need to put in an extra bed, we will. She will always be welcome forever." And they drank to that. And then Simon stood up and he said, "Marguerite, you're Ivy. It's your middle name. You're kind of invasive. And you wrap yourself around everything. But we love you." And then he looked at his woman and he said, "Francine, you're Holly. That's your middle name. You're kind of stiff. You're a little prickly. You're beautiful. And I love you." And then Ron played his guitar. Oh, the holly and the ivy, when they are both full grown, of all the trees that are in the wood, the holly bears the crown. Oh, the rising of the sun and the running of the deer, the playing of the merry organ, sweet singing in the choir. Oh, ivy wraps about you, arising from the ground, and protects us in this wilderness with her cascading gown. Oh, the rising of the sun and the running of the deer, the playing of the merry organ, sweet singing in the choir.
Andy Offutt Irwin, Love at 85 from the album Love, an Armadillo Migration. That's our show, so this is David Oates saying goodbye. And thanks for listening to Wordland. And thanks to WUGA, which has given Wordland such wonderful support through the years. Wordland is a Monkey Sound production recorded in the studios of WUGA. If you have questions or comments, please call your radio station or send email to dvdoates@aol.com. That's dvdoates@aol.com.